Hello there, and welcome to the Scary Story Show. Sorry about the really shitty text-to-speech bullshit. This is only a test show. All stories today are read by Mr. Creepypasta. This one is Mr. Toothy.
Have you ever heard the story of Bloody Mary? Most people have. She's the ghost of a woman who died in a horrible car accident, or some despotic queen, or killer, or something like that. You could even summon her in a mirror, if you're so inclined. It probably happened the night of a sleepover. You and your friends would go into the bathroom with a flashlight, turn out the lights, spin around 3, 5, 13 times, say Bloody Mary some number of times, then expect her gory face to appear in the mirror. Afterwards, you'd expect her to come out and rip your face off. Or something. Or, more likely, nothing will happen at all. One of your nervous friends would scream that they saw something in the mirror, then everyone run out screaming after turning on the lights. However, there was another creature similar to Bloody Mary. The brave and foolish alike already know his name. Mr. Toothy. He doesn't look as surly as other ghosts. He always has a smile on his face, a wide, broad, gleaming smile. He's happy to pull you into the mirror with him, or to crawl out and follow you if you try to leave. He's colorful, zany, and has a special twinkle in his beady little eyes when he sees you. You probably won't be able to see him, though. Well, you can try to see him. Like with Bloody Mary, you have to go into your bathroom, but unlike with her, you have to do it alone. It has to be dark out. The middle of the night, in fact. Bring a little candle with you. Turn off the bathroom lights and close the door, and close any curtains or shades over the windows. It'll be just you, the candle, and the mirror. Get acquainted with the feelings of standing there in the flickering candlelight. Gaze into your reflection, your face faintly aglow. Calm yourself as best you can. Take a deep breath in through your nose and let it out slowly. Do this a few times. Feel the silence all around you. Next, close your eyes tightly. You might think the mirror is reflecting you and only you, but anything could be in that mirror when you're not looking. A big smile glowing in the glow of your little flame. White gloved hands with fingers long as your arms, about to pull you in. You don't know what's there, but you came for Mr. Toothy. Anything could happen. With your eyes still closed, ignore any feelings of dread and knock gently on the mirror 3 times. Then, in a good, strong tone, repeat 3 times. Mr. Toothy is a scaredy cat. Mr. Toothy is a scaredy cat. Mr. Toothy is a scaredy cat. There. Now you've taunted him. You're probably just standing there, your eyes still closed. He could have already been in front of you, grinning ear to ear, ready to show you who's the real scaredy cat. Now you have to open your eyes. So you do. Check to make sure that your face is in the mirror, not Mr. Toothy's. It's just you. Right? So you decide that Mr. Toothy is just a stupid urban legend. There's nothing to be afraid of. You still turn the bathroom lights back on before blowing out your candle. You go play video games or read, maybe call a friend and chat for a while. And then you go to bed. But you'll start to think, what if Mr. Toothy was real? What if he heard you? What if instead of popping out and getting you right away, he prefers to take his time? The next time you're home alone, you might see a half glance of white and red out of the corner of your eye. You might hear the faint squeak of a clown nose over your music. You might feel two glittery little eyes watching you when you're in the shower. The great weed of paranoia will grow from its small seed in your stomach. Looking in the mirror at night becomes more difficult with each passing day. You hear footsteps knocking at the door, but see no one and nothing. The nightmares will begin, filled with big toothy grins in the darkness, opening to swallow you up. The ring or buzz of a phone will make you jump. You'll hesitate to answer, expecting to hear the raspy, taunting voice of Toothy. You'll go out less and less, but still be scared in your own house. You know that when you least expect it. Toothy will finally get you. The ridiculous sense of hopelessness will consume you until suddenly you realize just how funny it all is. He's just a clown, isn't he? He might be a bit more malevolent, but doesn't that add to the laughs? The big white teeth and gloves, the colorful markings all over his face, the way he stalks you in the dark and watches you through the mirrors, isn't it all so awful that you just want to laugh and smile? Don't forget to smile. Make yourself feel better. You'll want to laugh and laugh together, so you'll start welcoming the appearance of the clown. You might notice your teeth growing ever so brighter, ever so bigger, your face gaining a little more color, your fingers getting a teensy bit longer every day. What fun! Soon, you won't feel paranoid or dread. Your life will be full of whimsy and laughter. Laughter at the senselessness of it all, the utter and complete lack of point. But you don't need a point, do you? You know you're not a scaredy cat, and Mr. Toothy isn't a scaredy cat either. It's been a few days, perhaps a week, since you last saw your friends. Maybe you should pay them a surprise visit. Let them know you're all better. But before you go, you should head into the bathroom and freshen up. You've been nervous about mirrors since that night with that silly game. Look once, then look again. A happy and colorful clown grins back at you. Now, won't your friends be delighted to see you in their own mirrors?
That was Mr. Toothy by G.R. Wilson. Next up, we have the Black Friday incident.
The early stages of production on the film Toy Story were a complete nightmare. The production was in a sort of development hell until the infamous Black Friday incident. Disney harassed the, at the time, new animation studio Pixar constantly. They were to produce and release the film, and they wanted results as quickly as possible. Disney tried everything to eliminate Pixar's efforts to deviate from the Disney formula, even at times threatening to shut the production down. Disney sent notes on revisions that they thought would improve the film. They insisted through their notes, which all read, "Edge. The film needs more edge." The people working on the film at the time struggled so hard to maintain all of Disney's notes and demands. Once a week, they were required to fly across the country to the Disney offices to present them with progress. Every time, they were met with the same response. "Edge. The film needs more edge." Pixar revised the film so hard to meet the deadline that it resulted in some rather interesting changes. In order to achieve edge, the film became quite a lot darker. Woody became a wildly unlikable character, much more angry and far less comedic than in the final film. Bo Peep's role in the story was far more prevalent, often flirtatious towards the male characters, and is the first to accuse Woody of pushing Buzz out the window. Buzz Lightyear was referred to at this point in production as Lunar Larry. He's highly reminiscent of an older superhero, talking in a deep voice and is even more deluded and ignorant of his surroundings. The other toys were relatively unchanged, save for minor aesthetic differences. Pixar employees worked literally 24/7 nonstop. Director John Lasseter joked on more than one occasion that he had the best parking spot at the office because his car hadn't moved for over 3 days. Some of the writers and storyboard artists began to suffer from chronic insomnia. A few writers reported seeing visions of Buzz and Woody taunting them on their lack of progress, chanting, "Edge, the film needs more edge. Many of the initial writers quit due to the stress that it was putting on their personal lives, much to the distress of the remaining crew. By November of 1992, there were two of the five writers left, and only one of the three storyboard artists. The remaining storyboard artist was named Ralph Thompson. He joined the Pixar team in the winter of 1987, working on short films such as Tin Toy and Knick Knack. He, at the same time, did some storyboard work for The Nightmare Before Christmas with fellow artist Joe Ramp. Joe came down with a serious illness and hadn't been to work in a week. Ralph worked constantly in fear of the inevitable correction by Disney. More edge. More edge. Each presentation meant another row of sleepless nights of rewriting and redrawing the same characters in the same bedroom over and over and over. It was maddening. One morning, John Lasseter, Andrew Staton, and other higher-ups at Pixar came into the office and told everybody what happened at their last meeting. Disney felt that things were not looking very good for the film and demanded that in less than a week, they see the complete film in story reels with massive revision. There was a general groan and whine from the crew, and they went back to work. Ralph worked harder than any others involved. Sometimes, at 2 o'clock in the morning, one of the writers would walk into Ralph's office with a packet of newly written scenes, more to draw. And with more drawings meant more scratch voice work. When a film is still in the writing or storyboard stages, artists will do temporary voices for the story reels. He had Disney's vague instructions racing through his mind. More. More edge. Edgier. More. We want results, people. Edgier. This is a business. Faster. More edge. Move on already. He thought to himself this exactly. The film needed an edge. It needed to be darker, more cynical. It needed more adult humor in situations. It needed an attitude. Of course. Ralph! How couldn't you have seen it sooner? Edge. All these hundreds of hours bent over a desk and all you needed was edge. Why didn't you listen sooner? He gave the film an edge. The story reels were flown over with the main crew to the head offices at Disney. The date was November 27th, 1992. Black Friday. The film was brought into the Disney screening room. The reel was about 48 and a half minutes long. The movie started out as a western-style shootout between Woody and Andy, resulting in Andy being shot down. It is revealed that this was just a game played inside of Andy's mind. The film continued on with little problems for about the first 20 minutes or so, though several gags seemed off with the overall tone of the film. For example, Mr. Potato Head would pull one of his eyes out and kick them under Bo Peep's dress for a look-see. There were several scenes of Woody yelling at the toys to stop caring about Buzz, or Larry, and to pay attention to him, culminating in insults and minor acts of violence. The scene comes where Andy can only take one toy to Pizza Planet, and Woody pushes Buzz out the window. Woody offers to shake hands with Buzz or Larry, only to throw him out the window. There is a stock smashing noise. The other toys are shocked and antagonize Woody for what he's done. Woody shows little remorse and screams at Slinky Dog to make the toys stop harassing him. After much yelling, one of the Green Army men says the word, "God damn." The toys grab Woody and toss him out the window as well. He falls onto the ground with a low thump. Cheering is heard from the interior of the house. The quality on the storyboards becomes much less refined, almost like chicken scratches. Woody gets up and sees Buzz or Larry. Buzz's body shattered on impact. His arms and legs were broken off and located only a few inches away. There was a large crack down the middle of the chest, revealing a mess of buttons and wires inside. He gave off a sort of electrical twitch motion of his head. His eyes looked as if they were about to pop out of their plastic sockets. The twitching stops after a few moments, and Woody looks in fear at what he's done to Buzz, and runs off. There's a jump cut to the scene where the two get stuck in a claw machine. The storyboard art is back to its normal level of quality. The machine is filled with sunglasses wearing pizzas, as opposed to the aliens in the final movie. Buzz is completely unharmed and intact. The scene is almost verbatim the final film. Sid, the antagonist in control of the claw, is wearing a yellow shirt and is smoking 3 cigarettes at once. The claw grabs Woody and Buzz, putting them in the clutches of Sid. There is another jump cut, once again returning to the chicken scratch style of artwork. The scene is inside of Sid's room. Woody looks around the room in fear. He tiptoes around the room and collapses after seeing one of Sid's mutant toys. The reel now shows unrelated test animations of the characters running. A few seconds of Buzz running in place, a few seconds of Woody running, and nearly a minute or two running together. The footage is distorted, and Spanish text is present on the screen. There is now a shot of Woody standing in front of a black background, and the trademark Pixar ball is rolling around in the distance. The animation now is the traditional animation style of a typical 2D Disney film. Woody is completely naked, with anatomically correct features, and stares directly into the camera. His flesh begins to rot away, with the exception of his eyes, which remain intact. Woody begins to moan in a low voice. What remains of his lips curl into a smile, bits of flesh peeling off as this happens. He lifts up his decomposing arm manually and waves it to the camera. His fingers dig into his eyes. Dark blood oozes out of its sockets. Woody begins to scream and growl. Don't you want it?
Don't you want it?
Don't you love it?
He digs so deep as to rip the entire top half of his head off. Woody gives a sigh of relief and begins eating the flesh off the skull before tossing it aside. He writes the word edge on the screen with his rotting fingertip. The remaining 15 minutes of the reel were pencil scribbles accompanied by the shrill screams of a young woman. The word edge is burned into the projection screen. The screening ended in complete silence. Chairman of Disney at the time, Jeffrey Katzenberg, walked out of the screening room, quietly telling his colleagues, "Notes." They were following all the notes we gave them. Upon returning to the Pixar offices, writer Pete Docter found the body of Ralph Thompson in an enormous pile of paper in his office. Further analysis found that the cause of death was a heart attack brought on by a lack of sleep and stress. The papers were all storyboards and animation cells of the final coherent scene of Woody. The word edge scrawled on the back of each one. After the Black Friday screening, Disney was far less involved with the film. Pixar was given the freedom to make the film their way. The film went on to be a huge success, both critically and financially. The Black Friday incident still remains very much a mystery.
This next one is a long one. It's The Proposition by Ebenezer Crowley.
Yet another grim day started with the alarm clock blaring maddeningly. The day itself wasn't the issue, or even the morning alarm. More specifically, Kathy dreaded facing her husband, Marty. Their marriage, once brilliant with the colors of life, now dwindled into grays. 14 long years of marriage to this man has been like a stint of purgatory. Marty's consistency and predictability, once a source of comfort, now pained Kathy. His haircut, the same haircut that he has had since he was 16, irked her. "You are a man. Get a grown-up's haircut, idiot." Of course, she never spoke this aloud, but her internal dialogue provided the soundtrack. Every morning was filled with the same tired jokes. "Is this coffee? Or is this mud? It looks like blah, 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 blah." Even his boyish smile, wide and toothy, infuriated her. "The hell are you so happy about?" She wore a porcelain smile, choking back the urge to strangle him. He never complained or argued. Even when she tried to goat him into an argument, he kept the same calm demeanor. Show some emotion, you robot, she screamed in her head. Marty worked as an accountant. He was smart, Jeopardy smart. While they watched evening game shows, Marty would answer questions a split second before the contestant. He wasn't always correct, but he usually was. Why don't you go on one of these shows and win us some money? Kathy often asked. He always blushed the notion aside, saying that he wasn't that smart, stating, anyone could answer these questions. Kathy couldn't. She found his modesty dishonest. He knows he's smart, she complained internally. He's just fishing for compliments. At this point in her life, Kathy couldn't stomach anything about her husband. Even the way that he drank his coffee grinded on her nerves. She was sick of how he talked, sick of how he smiled. Kathy was sick of him altogether. Her only morning rest came after Marty left for work. Kathy would have 60 minutes of alone time before she had to leave for work herself. The front door shut as Marty left, and Kathy exhaled deeply in relief. This morning, she decided to catch up on some light reading while enjoying some green tea. Well, she tried to enjoy it. Kathy didn't care for tea, but she read that it was the only healthy thing to drink besides water. The doorbell rang out. No, that idiot came back. He must have forgotten his house keys again. Why he insists on keeping it separate from his car keys, I will never know. She slumped out of the puffy recliner and lumbered to the front door, expecting her dull husband. However, on the other side of the door stood a thin man in a dark blue suit and matching fedora. He looked like he'd come straight out of a Humphrey Bogart movie or something. His pencil-thin mustache danced on his upper lip as he spoke. Hello, ma'am. I'm hoping you can spare a moment to hear my proposition. Normally, the door would be closed before a door-to-door salesman's first sentence was out, but Kathy was caught off guard. Kathy composed herself for a moment. I'm not sure what you want, but I'm not buying anything. She spoke her well-rehearsed line. Besides the salespeople and religious zealots, she typically had to fend off charity workers and Girl Scouts. Those damn cookies go straight to her thighs. My good madam, I have no intention of selling you anything. He smiled at her with a wink. The man brushed her aside as he strode into her living room. Now, I will be quick, as I know you have to be getting to work. Wait, who said that you could... How did you know that I had to... Kathy stopped talking. She couldn't finish her sentence. Flabbergasted. Yes, she was flabbergasted at the gall of this man. The man sat in her recliner and sipped her tea. Nasty stuff, this tea. Is health really worth it? He laughed. Please, sit, Mrs. Miller. We have much to discuss. Who do you think you are? Kathy dashed over to her kitchen counter to pick up her cell phone to call the police. Where did her phone go? She left it on the charger this morning in the kitchen counter. A whistle rang from the living room, where her uninvited guest waved her cell phone back and forth between his thumb and index finger. Mrs. Miller, please. I would like to get down to business.
How?
Confusion caused her head to hurt.
Could this really be happening?
How? That is easy. "'Tis but a sleight of hand, a little hocus-pocus. The man shook his head, and the phone disappeared. Mrs. Miller, if you would like me to leave, just ask.
Please leave, she scowled as she pointed to the front door, and give me back my phone.
He let out a sigh. All right, all right. Although, it is a shame we didn't talk about your husband's unfortunate accident. He rose from the fuffy chair and turned to the door.
Wait.
Kathy didn't realize that she said the words until it had slipped out of her lips. Did she really want to talk to this man? She then noticed his eyes. Something was wrong about them. He had no irises. Just pupils.
swimming on white globes. And she could swear for a brief moment, his teeth were all filed to points. So many things seemed wrong with this man, although she doubted the man was the right term. Every fiber of her being told her this creature was no man, and to run. But deep down, she knew she had to hear what it had to say. She just had to know. He grinned, as if hearing her innermost thoughts, and spun on his heels to face her. Now. Now we're being civilized. Shall we sit? He gestured towards the couch. Oh, and your phone is in your front pocket. He gave a nonchalant wave towards Kathy. She felt the outside of her pocket, and her fingers slid over the outline of her phone. It hadn't been there a moment before. Kathy sat on the edge of the couch. Her hands cupped on her lap, relaxing was not an option.
You may call me Mr. Styx.
He reached over to the end table and picked up a framed picture of Marty and Kathy.
What a fine-looking couple you make.
His grin widened. Kathy could feel the warmth of her cheeks as her anger arose.
What is it you want, Mr. Styx?
It's not what I want, but what you want.
He set the picture back on the end table and straightened it a couple of times until it was exactly where he found it. He pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped off his hands as if he had touched something distasteful.
You have a relationship problem. I am offering a cure. I am offering you to end your marriage without any messy divorce or splitting up of the assets. In fact, with the insurance policy you already have on your husband, you could live comfortably for the rest of your life.
He leaned forward with his hands together.
Sound interesting to you, Mrs. Miller?
She regarded his face for a moment. His face was narrow, with high cheekbones and a pointy nose. He seemed almost cartoonish. How do you know that I have relationship issues?
Good madam, knowing things is my business. Like when you were 8 and let the neighbor boy see up your skirt, quite exhibitionist.
He winked at her from across the table.
Are you the devil?
Her eyes widened.
Why, madam, you flatter me.
His voice had a delighted tone. I assure you, I am not. But I do represent him. The boss can't be expected to handle every matter that comes across his desk.
Why are you here? Why me?
Her voice was shaking.
To help you, of course.
He tried to sound reassuring.
You know another client of ours. So while I was in the area, I wanted to offer our services to you as well.
But I don't know anyone whose spouse was killed.
Exactly the point, he interrupted. We wouldn't be any good if anyone knew about it.
Mr. Six regarded the overwhelmed look on Kathy's face for a moment before speaking.
Let me cut to the chase, so to speak. We are offering to kill your husband and end this travesty you call a marriage. You, my dear, get the freedom you desire.
Kathy contemplated. But why was she contemplating this? Was life really that bad? No, she couldn't continue. She had to do something. Why not just leave? Why not just divorce him? She loved the house. She couldn't leave it. Was it really that easy?
Yes. It is, he said,
interrupting her thoughts again.
You can choose not to accept my proposition, Mrs. Miller. You are under no obligations, however.
Perhaps I should show you your future. Should you decide to pass my offer? He closed his eyes and raised his hand. A moment later, a vision started. There was a flash of light and Kathy woke in a large movie theater sitting next to Mr. Sticks. He munched on popcorn, looking up at the screen. Kathy began to ask what was happening, but Mr. Sticks shushed her and pointed to the screen. She moved down a couple of seats away from him. Being that close to him unnerved her. He chuckled to himself, for this was not the first person to squirm in his presence. He rather liked it. An image of the outside of her house flickered on the screen. The camera panned and zoomed in on the front door, which swung open, as if the camera itself had opened. The images of the living room flowed by, stopping on Marty. He stood there in a familiar blue shirt. He was older, but wore the same stupid smile. His hair had more gray than brown, but besides that, he looked the same. He walked out the front door, headed off to work. Some things never change, Mr. Sticks laughed. The camera panned to the bedroom.
Here's the good part, he grinned.
His grin made munching the popcorn a little difficult, but he managed. On the screen, sitting on the bed, a haggard Kathy stared at her feet, her hands rubbing over her lap. Tears rolling down her cheeks as she began to sob.
You never leave.
His voice actually sounded sympathetic.
You still complained and talked about leaving, but year after year. No divorce, no leaving, and no freedom.
Kathy felt tears running down her cheeks. She looked so old on the screen compared to how Marty had looked. Her heart sank. And then...
there's this.
Again, Mr. Sticks pointed at the screen. Kathy glanced at Mr. Sticks, and then looked back up at the screen to see her older self picking up the object from her lap. What was it? In horror, Kathy watched her older form fall limp, blood sprayed against the walls. All breath left her lungs. Panic struck her, and she began looking around for an exit. The theater spun. Her eyes could no longer focus. She needed an escape. Mr. Sticks snapped his fingers, and they were back in the living room. Kathy felt her head, making sure that she didn't have any new holes. She glared at Mr. Sticks. You bastard! How could you?
That is the future you create, not me. I am your only option to avoid that unfortunate fate.
He tried to look sympathetic, but the emotion was lost on him again. So if I decide to accept your offer, I will avoid that future.
You mean you won't swallow a gun barrel? That I can promise.
What do you want? Why help me? The fight had been taken out of her. She couldn't end up living the life that she had seen on the screen.
The cost. It always comes down to that, doesn't it?
Mr. Sticks crossed his legs and folded his hands in his lap.
The price is your soul.
He tapped his two index fingers together, awaiting a response. You want my soul? I can't do that! You're not one of those religious sorts, are you? Mr. Sticks rolls his eyes.
You humans have the whole idea wrong. This is a game, a bet, between two rivals. Just because you win a hand at poker doesn't mean you get to keep the cards, does it?
He opened his folded hands in a sign of trust.
Your soul isn't really yours to lose.
It is just a tally on a scorecard for bragging rights between two immortals. Kathy was at a loss.
All existence is a bet? Mind-blowing, I know. Believe it or not, we all work for the same team. Besides, what choice do you have?
She took a deep breath and nodded her head. How do we do this? That great relief came over her.
There was light at the end of the tunnel, and she could smell her freedom.
"Here is your contract." He pulled out a scroll from the inside of his coat pocket. "I know the scroll is a little old school, but we got them in bulk in the Dark Ages. Besides, why not stick with a classic?"
He handed the scroll to her.
"To sign, just stick your finger at the bottom."
Kathy pressed her finger on the bottom of the scroll. A red dot formed beneath her finger and began to spread. She quickly pulled her finger away and noticed blood coming from the tip.
"Now, that wasn't so bad." Mr. Styx rose from the chair. "Anyone can fake a signature. That's why we require blood."
He reached over and snatched the scroll from her hands.
"I will take that. Now, let me give you a receipt."
"Receipt? Why not?" Kathy was far beyond puzzled at that point, so she just decided to go with it.
"Of course, many people tend to pass this offer off as a dream, so we offer a reminder so they don't forget."
"You're not gonna brand me or something like that, are you?" Her voice shook.
"What?"
He sounded truly surprised by her query.
"Madam, we are not animals. You'll receive a paper receipt."
He pulled out a small square of paper, the same parchment as the scroll.
"One final question, Mrs. Miller. His end. Should he suffer?"
He tapped a pen against the small piece of paper.
"On a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being skinned alive with a butter knife, and 1 being a sudden heart attack. Of course, these are just examples. Each death is customized for the individual."
Kathy paused to think, but Marty's face appeared in her mind.
That smug smile.
"Let's go with a 3. She didn't want to be cruel after all. 3 seemed like a reasonable number. Mr. Styx scribbled 3 vertical lines, which crossed a point at 1/4 of their length. He circled the intersection, making it look like a crudely drawn bunch of wheat.
"Don't judge the artwork. We wouldn't want everything spelled out. No need for evidence to be found just laying around."
He slyly smiled and handed the receipt to her.
"This matter should be resolved for you in the next month, give or take a few days. We like to leave it as a little bit of a surprise. In the meantime, live as you normally would. Now you have a good day, Mrs. Miller. I imagine you and I will not speak again regarding this agreement." And with a wink,
he was gone. No need for pretense any longer. Using the door was no longer necessary. Kathy decided to fake a headache that day and phoned in sick to work. A long bath was in order with her favorite candles. Over the next week, Kathy didn't reflect much on what was to come. As Mr. Styx said, she recalled it as more of a vague dream, figment of her imagination. The receipt was the only reminder of that day. A marker declaring the reality of her decision. On day 8, the guilt began. That morning, she pulled the receipt with the 3 lines out. The tan color, along with the heavy weight and unclean edges, made the paper feel hundreds of years old. Did he deserve the suffer? Wouldn't a single line have been sufficient? Kathy decided to make Marty's final days as pleasant as possible. She made his favorite meals and watched his stupid sci-fi shows. She could stomach this for a few weeks. All the while, her porcelain smile never faded. On the evening of day 12, Marty decided to go to a poker game with some co-workers. It was unusual for him to go out on a weeknight, but he seemed excited to get out of the house. This gave Kathy some time to relax and maybe get some laundry done. Kathy began putting away some laundry. She noticed that one of Marty's socks had been mixed with her clothes. She opened his sock drawer to put away the stray. In the back corner of the drawer,
was a familiar piece of paper. She withdrew it from the drawer, recognizing the receipt. What was it doing in the drawer? She went to her jewelry box, where she had originally kept the receipt, only to find it was exactly where she had left it. Then, what is this? She wondered. She unfolded the parchment. Sure enough, it was a receipt, with the scribble marks similar to her own. At that precise moment, a voice from over her shoulder whispered in her ear.
I see you found Marty's receipt.
Kathy clutched her fist to her chest, but dared not turn around. She knew who was behind her. Gone were the blue suit and pencil mustache. Behind Kathy stood what once was Mr. Styx, a vision of his skeletal body wrapped tightly in brittle, dry skin, exposed bones, and fiery eyes. She dared not turn and face him. The vision told her as much.
You see, Marty sought me out weeks before you and I met.
She felt Mr. Styx's bony fingers on both of her shoulders, his long nails sharpened to jagged points.
Tough luck. He opted for 5 lines. Don't worry, my dear. I will honor my side of the agreement and pay Marty a visit soon enough.
She could hear the crackling of his skin as he smiled.
A deal is a deal. Now, shall we begin? His bony fingers dug into her shoulders. It's all right to scream.
Our final story today is entitled, The Night I Choose to Remember.
I'm putting this on the internet only because I know it really happened, and feel everybody needs to know. It's haunting me. It's haunting me not to, so I'm trying to get some relief. I don't care if you don't hear this. Having posted it satisfies me enough that I've done my part. When I was in elementary school, I can specifically remember when I somehow developed nightmares. I had dreams often where I was abducted by aliens, and that was often enough to terrify me. Their simple appearance and apparent desire to take me from my family only added to my fear. And now that I'm a full-grown adult, however, I realize there were two very strange patterns around this that I overlooked as a child. Things only the insightful mind of an adult would have thought to notice. And the terrified whims of a restless child could easily ignore. The first thing I noticed was strange to realize and perplexes me to this day. It was the fact that I had never known about aliens before I started having the nightmares. I hadn't even seen E.T. yet, which was obviously a bit strange for my age, but it was the truth. We didn't even own the movie at the time. This was the thing that worries me even now. How could I have nightmares about an idea I shouldn't have known existed? The second thing I can remember about these early years is perhaps the more frightening of the two, and is in fact the reason that I'm here telling this story today. My nightmares, as I mentioned, were recurring, but as I'm sure you've guessed, they were credited to real events. That dreadful night, that horrible and awful night I want so desperately to forget. Before I go further into the night, I should probably briefly give you a background on myself. My name isn't necessary. I don't think it matters what I look like, but my family was starting to find its feet. I had both my parents around and doing the best they could for two young children. I was probably 7 or 8, considering my sister was able to walk at the time and is about 5 years younger than me. I slept in the top bunk. I would often stay up late at night, feeling so sly my parents never caught me, or just staring out the curtain window, hypnotized by the glowing effect of streetlights through the thin white curtain. It wasn't a perfect life, as I've come to realize, but at the time, I was just a happy kid. One night, though, I had the most frightening dream. I was looking out the window of a building I vaguely recognized to be a variation of my school classroom. Now, I know that dreams can work like that. I use places from memory to create something familiar, yet even if it's an imperfect recreation, you have this feeling that makes you automatically recognize where you are. For whatever strange reason, it was night, and everyone was in class like normal, lights on, so as to ward off the eerie night vibe of it all. That said, things escalated quickly. Rather, I was dropped into the dream while things were escalating. I was running to the window, as was everyone else, and almost immediately upon me arriving at the window, the power went out and an intense glow began emanating from outside that could not have been regular school lights. In my dream, a large spin-top shape flying saucer had landed in the courtyard of our school. I turned, looking slightly to my left out the window, and although it was just a dream, that sight traumatized me all the same. I watched my dad carrying my little sister, as I mentioned, barely able to walk, as he had no doubt come to pick me up from after my school daycare service. He saw the saucer, and although I know I witnessed it happen, I can't remember the details of how it happened, and can only recall this happening because I feel it like a sixth sense, or perhaps just a repressed memory. I only remember the overwhelming feeling of grief as I watched the doors on the alien shuttle open, and several little men kill my father as he desperately tried to defend my sister. I can't remember what happened to her. I've always assumed that she was taken aboard the ship, but I suppose I don't want to know if that isn't true. And a worse fate was bestowed upon her. I must have screamed in agony because the aliens turned to look specifically at me through the window. At least I think that's why. And come to think of it, I guess not because they burst into the room and once more specifically came for me. I don't recall what happened. That's what I dreamed. That's what reoccurred in my nightmares every so often for about 5 years after. The first night I woke up crying, I didn't scream and didn't yell. I just cried as my mom came in, hearing my pitiful sobs to comfort me. I fought the nightmare for a few years. But one night it broke me again, sobbing in fear of something my body refused to let me remember. Then there was a night. A night I cannot forget, that haunts me to this day. I was 13 and headed to high school soon, and I remember my family was packing up and moving the next morning, and as a result, I was sleeping on the floor, and even though it was a carpet, it was wholly uncomfortable to be on the ground. I wasn't having an easy time getting to sleep. I've always been one to sleep on my side, maybe my back, but never my stomach, because it always felt like I was going to puke up my own intestines laying on it. That night, I woke up uncomfortable and in an odd fashion. I was in the anatomical position, laying on my stomach and my head facing to my left. The two things I noticed immediately wrong were I was not snuggling my favorite stuffed animal, don't judge, that I was on my stomach. Uncomfortable, I tried adjusting by lifting and twisting my body in the direction my head was laying. As I lifted my head in anticipation of this action, however, I met a startling halt. Something extremely stubborn was above my head and pushing my head back down into my pillow. And what I might add was an unusually gentle, but mechanically forceful fashion. I tried to scream, but nothing came out. Hell, I can't even recall if I opened my mouth. It was like I was paralyzed and unable to do anything but perceive the room around me, and then I noticed something strange about the carpet. I could feel the carpet there, but not actually with my body. It felt as though I were in a dream. My mind recognized the carpet was there, like my mind was being told what to experience rather than experiencing it myself. The same feeling applied to the light in my room, although I had a lamp in the general direction of the light. I felt... I knew it was packed away with the rest of the things in my room for when we moved the next day. With my face in the pillow and the strange sixth sense-like feeling, my thought suddenly rushed to the nightmare that I'd mentioned was reoccurring up to that point. Before I could make any real connections, though, I suddenly was feeling relaxed and drifted to slumber in seconds. Something extremely rare for me. The next morning, I didn't remember the events. Almost as they weren't important, so I'd let myself forget. I only suddenly remembered them a few weeks later, almost without warning. I, of course, realized I should have told my parents. However, I felt the statute of limitations to bring up a silly nightmare had long passed, and I felt it was too embarrassing to bring up anyways. Honestly, I was far too spooked to ever want to think about what may have really happened that night. I mentioned that there was something that you need to know about all this, though, didn't I? Well, having this experience haunt me my entire life has given me plenty of time to contemplate, and finally I think I've connected the dots. Despite the fact that you may call me crazy, I know what was wrong that night. Every night I've left this unresolved, I have had to endure the trauma all over again, imagining this incident. When the story is finished, I know I can begin to rest as my responsibility to you will be fulfilled. I went to sleep in my room and I woke up someplace else. Where for sure I cannot say, but I was not home. Whoever took me, albeit unintentionally, made that clear by trying to make me believe I was still home using that stimulation of a carpet floor. They attempted to make me believe that the light they were working on me with was my own lamp. It was the same trick they'd used every time they'd come for me. And they'd have me believe I was staring at a glowing picture-perfect window. But my mind fought back that night and gave me the power to see through the haze, just like I fought to protect me from the horrors of witnessing that event in my nightmare, just like it gave me the nightmare to tell me something was wrong. You see, they say, when you're exposed to a horrific or traumatic event, your mind will recede into a happy place. Something familiar, so as to survive the events unscathed. And theoretically, I guess someone could abuse that happy place with the right technology, or even telepathic powers if you want to get supernatural, to convince someone an event never really happened. Usually our minds fight back to keep us from permanently falling into our happy place, to prevent us from becoming insane or even falling comatose. My mind fought back that night because I knew there was something out there abusing this survival technique, triggering my place of safety so that I'd never know the truth of what happens when we sleep, the truth to why we have dreams. Although I know my memories of the true events to those nights won't ever come back, I know the truth of every night I choose to forget, thanks to that one night my mind chose to remember. And although my tale is over, I'd like to take note that I've never had an incident since then, and can feel that it won't ever happen again, probably because of that night that they lost control of me. I doubt that I'm a special case, though. I doubt that I'm the first to report this or break this hold that they have on us, the strongest to resist it or the best at it, or even more frightening to face, realistically. I doubt I'm the last. So the next time you swear to God that the last dream you had was too familiar or too real, you may want to prepare yourself, because the truth is out there. And every time I think about it, I remember just why I don't want to know it. As I said, your mind only plays these tricks, the very tricks they abuse to protect you from a traumatic experience.
Thank you for listening to the Scary Story Show. As I said, this is a test show, and will be a little different if we make any more. We do not plan on using text-to-speech again. Anyway, it has been a pleasure to see all of your beautiful faces today, as they winced in fear. Yet depending on downloading figures, we may make more of these. Comment and subscribe. Goodbye.